Chapter 5 The School of Night might debate philosophy, but on one point they were agreed. A witch would still have to be found. Matthew dispatched George and Kit to make inquiries in Oxford, as well as to ask after our mysterious alchemical manuscript. After supper on Thursday evening, we took our places around the hearth in the great hall. Henry and Tom read and argued about astronomy or mathematics. Walter and Kit played dice at a long table, trading ideas about their latest literary projects. I was reading aloud from Walter's copy of The Fairy Queen to practice my accent and enjoying it no more than I did most Elizabethan romances.
"The beginning is too abrupt, Kit. You'll frighten the audience so badly they'll leave the playhouse before the second scene," Walter protested. "It needs more adventure."
They had been dissecting Dr. Faustus for hours. Thanks to Widow Beaton, it had a new opening.
"You are not my Faustus, Walt, for all your intellectual pretensions," Kit said sharply. "Look what your meddling did to Edmund's story. The Fairy Queen was a perfectly enjoyable tale about King Arthur. Now it's a calamitous blend of Mallory and Virgil. It wends on, and Gloriana, please. The Queen is nearly as old as Widow Beaton and just as crotchety. It will astonish me if Edmund finishes it, with you telling him what to do all the time. If you want to be immortalized on the boards, talk to Will. He's always hard up for ideas."
"Is that agreeable to you, Matthew?" George prompted.
He was updating us on his search for the manuscript that would one day be known as Ashmole 782.
"I'm sorry, George. Did you say something?"
There was a flash of guilt in Matthew's distracted gray eyes. I knew the signs of mental multitasking. It had gotten me through many a faculty meeting. His thoughts were probably divided among the conversations in the room, his ongoing review of what went awry with Widow Beaton, and the contents of the mailbags that continued to arrive. None of the booksellers have heard of a rare alchemical work circulating in the city. I asked a friend at Christchurch, and he too knows nothing. Shall I keep asking for it?
Matthew opened his mouth to respond, but a crash sounded in the front hallway as the heavy front door flew open. He was on his feet in an instant. Walter and Henry jumped up and scrabbled for their daggers, which they'd taken to wearing morning, noon, and night.
"Matthew!"
boomed an unfamiliar voice, with a timbre that instinctively raised the hairs on my arms. It was too clear and musical to be human.
"Are you here, man?"
"Of course he's here," someone else replied, his voice lilting in the cadence of a Welsh native. "Use your nose. Who else smells like a grocer's shop the day fresh spices arrive from the docks?"
Moments later, two bulky figures swathed in rough brown cloaks appeared at the other end of the room, where Kit and George still sat with their dice and books. In my own time, professional football teams would have recruited the new arrivals. They had overdeveloped arms with prominent tendons, enlarged wrists, thickly muscled legs, and brawny shoulders. As the men drew closer, light from the candles caught their bright eyes and danced off the honed edges of their weapons. One was a blonde giant an inch taller than Matthew. The other was a redhead a good 6 inches shorter, with a decided squint to his left eye. Neither could be more than 30. The blonde was relieved, though he hid it quickly. The redhead was furious and didn't care who knew it.
"There you are. You gave us a fright disappearing without leaving a word," the blonde man said mildly, drawing to a stop and sheathing his long, exceedingly sharp sword. Walter and Henry, too, withdrew their weapons. They recognized the men.
"Galloglass, why are you here?"
Matthew asked the blonde warrior with a note of wary confusion.
"We're looking for you, of course. Hancock and I were with you on Saturday."
Galloglass's chilly blue eyes narrowed when he didn't receive a reply. He looked like a Viking on the brink of a killing spree.
"In Chester."
"Chester?" Matthew's expression turned to dawning horror.
"Chester?"
"Aye, Chester," repeated the red-headed Hancock.
He glowered and peeled sodden leather gauntlets from his arms, tossing them onto the floor near the fireplace.
When you didn't meet up with us as planned on Sunday, we made inquiries. The innkeeper told us you'd left, which came as something of a surprise, and not only because you hadn't settled the bill.
He said you were sitting by the fire drinking wine one moment and gone the next, Galloglass reported.
The maid, the little one with the black hair who couldn't take her eyes off you, caused quite a stir. She insisted you were taken by ghosts.
I closed my eyes in sudden understanding. The Matthew Royden who had been in 16th century Chester vanished because he was displaced by the Matthew who'd traveled here from modern-day Oxfordshire. When we left, the 16th century Matthew, presumably, would reappear. Time wouldn't allow both Matthews to be in the same place at the same moment. We had already altered history without intending to do so.
It was All Hallows' Eve, so her story made a certain sort of sense, Hancock conceded, turning his attention to his cloak. He shook the water from its folds and flung it over a nearby chair, releasing the scent of spring grass into the winter air.
Who are these men, Matthew? I moved closer to get a better look at the pair. He turned and settled his hands on my upper arms, keeping me where I was.
They're friends, Matthew said.
But his obvious effort to regroup made me wonder if he was telling the truth.
Well, well. She's no ghost.
Hancock peered over Matthew's shoulder and my flesh turned to ice. Of course Hancock and Galloglass were vampires. What other creatures could be that big and bloody-looking?
Nor is she from Chester, Galloglass said thoughtfully. Does she always have such a bright glam about her?
The word might be unfamiliar, but its meaning was clear enough. I was shimmering again. It sometimes happened when I was angry or concentrating on a problem. It was another familiar manifestation of a witch's power, and vampires could detect the pale glow with their preternaturally sharp eyes. Feeling conspicuous, I stepped back into Matthew's shadow.
That's not going to help, lady. Our ears are as sharp as our eyes. Your witch's blood is trilling like a bird.
Hancock's bushy red brows rose as he looked sourly at his companion.
Trouble always travels in the company of women. Trouble is no fool. Given the choice, I'd rather travel with a woman than with you.
The blonde warrior addressed Matthew.
It's been a long day. Hancock's ass is sore and he's hungry. If you don't tell him why there's a witch in your house and quickly, I don't have high hopes for her continued safety.
It must have to do with Beric, Hancock declared. Bloody witches, always causing trouble.
Beric? My pulse kicked up a notch. I recognized the name. One of the most notorious witch trials in the British Isles was connected to it. I searched my memory for the dates. Surely it had happened well before or after 1590, or Matthew wouldn't have selected this moment for our time walk. But Hancock's next words drove all thoughts of chronology and history from my mind.
That, or some new congregation business that Matthew will want us to sort out for him.
The congregation? Marlowe's eyes narrowed, and he looked at Matthew appraisingly.
Is this true? Are you one of the mysterious members?
Of course it's true. How do you imagine he's kept you from the noose, young Marlowe?
Hancock searched the room.
Is there something to drink other than wine? I hate these French pretensions of yours, de Clermont. What's wrong with ale?
Not now, Davy, Galloglass murmured to his friend, though his eyes were fixed on Matthew. My eyes were fixed on him, too, as an awful sense of clarity settled over me. Tell me you're not, I whispered. Tell me you didn't keep this from me.
I can't tell you that, Matthew said flatly. I promised you secrets, but no lies, remember?
I felt sick. In 1590, Matthew was a member of the congregation, and the congregation was our enemy.
And Beric? You told me there was no danger of being caught up in a witch hunt.
Nothing in Beric will affect us here, Matthew assured me. What has happened in Beric? Walter asked, uneasy. Before we left Chester, there was news out of Scotland. A great gathering of witches met in a village east of Edinburgh on All Hallows' Eve, Hancock said. There was talk again of the storm the Danish witches raised this past summer, and the spouts of seawater that foretold the coming of a creature with fearsome powers. The authorities have rounded up dozens of the poor wretches, Galloglass continued, his arctic blue eyes still on Matthew. The cunning woman in the town of Keith, Widow Samson, is awaiting the king's questioning in the dungeons of Holyrood Palace. Who knows how many will join her there before this business is done?
The king's torture, you mean, Hancock muttered. They say the woman has been locked into a witch's bridle so she cannot utter more charms against his majesty, and chained to the wall without food or drink.
I sat down abruptly.
Is this one of the accused, then? Galloglass asked Matthew.
And I'd like the witch's bargain, too, if I may. Secrets, but no lies.
There was a long silence before Matthew answered.
Diana is my wife, Galloglass.
You abandon us in Chester for a woman?
Hancock was horrified.
But we had work to do.
You have an unerring ability to grab the wrong end of the staff, Davy.
Galloglass's glance shifted to me.
Your wife? He said carefully. So this is just a legal arrangement to satisfy curious humans and justify her presence here while the congregation decides her future?
Not just my wife, Matthew admitted. She's my mate, too.
A vampire mated for life when compelled to do so by an instinctive combination of affection, affinity, lust, and chemistry. The resulting bond was breakable only by death. Vampires might marry multiple times, but most mated just once. Galloglass swore, though the sound of it was almost drowned out by his friend's amusement.
And His Holiness proclaimed the Age of Miracles had passed, Hancock crowed. Matthew de Clermont is mated at last.
But no ordinary placid human or properly schooled female huech who knows her place would do. Not for our Matthew. Now that he's decided at last to settle down with one woman, it had to be a witch. We have more to worry about than the good people of Woodstock, then.
What's wrong in Woodstock? I asked Matthew with a frown.
Nothing, Matthew said breezily. But it was the hulking blonde who held my attention.
Some old besom went into fits on market day. She's blaming it on you.
Galloglass studied me from head to toe, as if trying to imagine how someone so unprepossessing had caused so much trouble.
Widow Beaton, I said breathlessly.
The appearance of Francoise and Charles forestalled further conversation. Francoise had fragrant gingerbread and spiced wine for the warmbloods. Kit, who was never reluctant to sample the contents of Matthew's cellar, and George, who was looking a bit green after the evening's revelations, helped themselves. Both had the air of audience members waiting for the next act to start. Charles, whose task it was to sustain the vampires, had a delicate pitcher with silver handles and three tall glass beakers. The red liquid within was darker and more opaque than any wine. Hancock stopped Charles on his way to the head of the household.
I need something to drink more than Matthew does, he said, grabbing a beaker while Charles gasped at the affront.
Hancock sniffed the pitcher's contents and took that, too.
I haven't had fresh blood for 3 days. You have odd taste in women, de Clermont. But no one can criticize your hospitality.
Matthew motioned Charles in the direction of Galloglass, who also drank thirstily. When Galloglass took his final draught, he wiped his hand across his mouth.
Well, he demanded. You're tight-lipped, I know, but some explanation as to how you let yourself get into this seems in order. This would be better discussed in private, said Walter, eyeing George and the two demons. Why is that, Raleigh?
Hancock's voice took on a pugnacious edge.
De Clermont has a lot to answer for. So does his witch.
And those answers had best trip off her tongue. We passed a priest on the way. He was with two gentlemen who had prosperous waistlines. Based on what I heard, the Clermont's mate will have 3 days...
At least five, Galloglass corrected.
Maybe five, Hancock said, inclining his head in his companion's direction. Before she's held over for trial, 2 days to figure out what to say to the magistrates, and less than half an hour to come up with a convincing lie for the good father. You had best start telling us the truth.
All attention settled on Matthew, who stood mute.
The clock will strike the quarter hour soon, Hancock reminded him after some time had passed.
I took matters into my own hands. Matthew protected me from my own people.
Diana, Matthew growled.
Matthew? Meddled in the affairs of witches?
Galloglass's eyes widened slightly. I nodded. Once the danger passed, we were mated.
And all this happened between noon and nightfall on Saturday?
Galloglass shook his head.
You're going to have to do better than that, Auntie.
Auntie? I turned to Matthew in shock. First Beric, then the congregation, and now this.
This? Berserker is your nephew? Let me guess, he's Baldwin's son.
Galloglass was almost as muscle-bound as Matthew's copper-headed brother, and as persistent. There were other de Clermonts I knew, Godfrey, Louisa, and Hugh, who received only brief, cryptic mentions. Galloglass could belong to any of them, or to someone else on Matthew's convoluted family tree.
Baldwin?
Galloglass gave a delicate shiver.
Even before I became aware, I knew better than to let that monster near my neck. Hugh de Clermont was my father. For your information, my people were Ulfhethnar, not berserkers, and I'm only part Norse, the gentle part, if you must know. The rest is Scots by way of Ireland.
Foul-tempered, the Scots, Hancock added.
Galloglass acknowledged his companion's remark with a gentle tug on his ear. A golden ring glinted in the light, incised with the outlines of a coffin. A man was stepping free of it, and there was a motto around the edges. Your knights. I looked for a matching ring on Hancock's finger. There it was, oddly placed on his thumb. Here, at last, was evidence that Matthew was involved in the business of the Order of Lazarus, too.
Well, Galloglass drawled, sounding suddenly like the Scot he professed to be. There's always been a dispute about that. We're not really the shining armor type, are we, Davy?
No, but the de Clermonts have deep pockets. Money like that is hard to refuse, Hancock observed, especially when they promise you a long life for the enjoying of it.
They're fierce fighters, too.
Galloglass rubbed the bridge of his nose again. It was flattened, as though it had been broken and never healed properly.
Oh, aye. The bastards killed me before they saved me. Fixed my bad eye while they were at it,
Hancock said cheerfully, pointing to his gammy lid.
Then you're loyal to the de Clermonts. Sudden relief washed through me. I would prefer to have Galloglass and Hancock as allies rather than enemies, given the disaster unfolding.
Not always, replied Galloglass darkly. Not to Baldwin. He's a sly bugger. And when Matthew behaves like a fool, we pay no attention to him either.
Hancock sniffed and pointed to the gingerbread, which lay forgotten on the table.
Is someone going to eat that, or can we pitch it into the fire? Between Matthew's scent and Charles's cooking, I feel ill.
Given our approaching visitors, our time would be better spent devising a course of action than talking about family history,
Walter said impatiently.
Jesu, there's no time to come up with a plan, Hancock said cheerfully. Matthew and his lordship should say a prayer instead. They're men of God. Maybe he's listening.
Perhaps the witch could fly away, Galloglass murmured.
He held up both hands in mute surrender when Matthew glared at him.
Oh, but you can't.
All eyes turned to Marlowe. She can't even conjure Matthew a beard.
You've taken up with a witch against all the congregation's strictures, and she's worthless?
It was impossible to tell if Galloglass was more indignant or incredulous.
A wife who can summon a storm or give your enemy a horrible skin affliction has certain advantages, I grant you. But what good is a witch who can't even serve as her husband's barber?
Only Matthew would wed a witch from God knows where with no sorcery to speak of, Hancock muttered to Walter.
Quiet, all of you!
Matthew exploded.
I can't think for all the senseless chatter. It's not Diana's fault that Widow Beaton is a meddling old fool, or that she can't perform magic on command. My wife was spellbound, and there's an end to it. If one more person in this room questions me or criticizes Diana, I'll rip your heart out and feed it to you while it still beats.
There is our lord and master, Hancock said with a mocking salute. For a minute, I was afraid you were the one who was bewitched. Hang on, though. If she's spellbound, what's wrong with her? Is she dangerous? Mad? Both?
Unnerved by the influx of nephews, agitated parsons, and the trouble brewing in Woodstock, I reached behind me for the chair. With my reach restricted by the unfamiliar clothes, I lost my balance and began to fall. A rough hand shot out and gripped me by the elbow, lowering me to the seat with surprising gentleness.
It's all right, Auntie.
Galloglass made a soft noise of sympathy.
I'm not sure what's amiss in your head, but Matthew will take care of you. He has a warm spot in his heart for lost souls, bless him.
I'm dizzy, not deranged, I retorted. Galloglass's eyes were flinty as his mouth approached my ear.
Your speech is disordered enough to stand for madness, and I doubt the priest cares one way or the other. Given that you aren't from Chester or anywhere else I've been, and that's a fair number of places, Auntie. You might want to mind your manners, unless you want to find yourself locked in the church crypt.
Long fingers clamped around Galloglass's shoulder and pulled him away.
If you're quite finished trying to frighten my wife, a pointless exercise, I assure you, you might tell me about the men you passed,
Matthew said frostily.
Were they armed? No.
After a long, interested look at me, Galloglass turned toward his uncle.
And who is with the minister? How the hell should we know, Matthew? All three were warmbloods and not worth a second thought. One was fat and gray-haired, the other was medium-sized and complained about the weather,
Galloglass said impatiently.
Bidwell, Matthew and Walter said at the same moment. It's probably Iffley with him, remarked Walter. The two of them are always complaining about the state of the roads, the noise at the inn, the quality of the beer.
Who's Iffley? I wondered aloud.
A man who fancies himself the finest glover in all England. Summers works for him, Walter replied.
Master Iffley does craft the Queen's gloves, George acknowledged. He made her a single pair of hunting gauntlets 2 decades ago.
That's hardly enough to make Iffley the most important man for 30 miles, dearly as he might covet the honour.
Matthew snorted contemptuously.
Singly, none of them are terribly bright. Together, they're downright foolish. If that's the best the village can do, we can return to our reading.
That's it?
Walter's voice was brittle.
We sit and let them come to us?
Yes, but Diana doesn't leave my sight. All yours, Galloglass, Matthew warned. You don't have to remind me of my family duty, Uncle. I'll be sure your feisty wife makes it to your bed tonight.
Feisty, am I? My husband is a member of the congregation. A posse of men is coming on horseback to accuse me of harming a friendless old woman. I'm in a strange place and keep getting lost on my way to the bedroom. I still have no shoes, and I'm living in a dormitory full of adolescent boys who never stop talking, I fumed. But you needn't trouble yourself on my account. I can take care of myself.
Take care of yourself?
Galloglass laughed at me and shook his head.
No, you can't. And when the fighting's done, we'll need to see to that accent of yours. I didn't understand half of what you just said.
She must be Irish, Hancock said, glaring at me. That would explain the spellbinding and the disordered speech. The whole lot of them are mad.
She's not Irish, Galloglass said. Mad or no, I would have understood her accent if that were the case.
Quiet, Matthew bellowed.
The men from the village are at the gatehouse, Pierre announced in the ensuing silence.
Go and fetch them, Matthew ordered.
He turned his attention to me. Let me do the talking. Don't answer their questions unless and until I tell you to do so. Now, he continued briskly, we can't afford to have anything unusual happen tonight, as it did when Widow Beaton was here. Are you still dizzy? Do you need to lie down?
Curious. I'm curious, I said, hands clenched. Don't worry about my magic or my health. Worry about how many hours it's going to take you to answer my questions after the minister is gone. And if you try to wiggle out of them with the excuse that it's not my tale to tell, I'll flatten you.
You are perfectly fine, then.
Matthew's mouth twitched. He dropped a kiss on my forehead.
I love you, Marleon.
You might reserve your professions of love until later and give Auntie a chance to compose herself, Galloglass suggested.
Why does everyone feel compelled to tell me how to manage my own wife? Matthew shot back.
The cracks in his composure were starting to show.
I really couldn't say, Galloglass replied serenely.
She reminds me a bit of Granny, though.
We give Philippe advice morning, noon, and night about how best to control her. Not that he listens.
The men arranged themselves around the room. The apparent randomness of their positions created a human funnel, wider at the entrance to the room, narrower at the fireside where Matthew and I sat. As George and Kit would be the first to greet the man of God and his companions, Walter whisked away their dice and the manuscript of Dr. Faustus in favor of a copy of Herodotus's Histories. Though it was not a Bible, Raleigh assured us it would lend proper gravitas to the situation. Kit was still protesting the unfairness of the substitution when footsteps and voices sounded. Pierre ushered the three men inside. One so strongly resembled the reedy young man who had measured me for shoes that I knew at once he was Joseph Bidwell. He started at the sound of the door closing behind him and looked uneasily over his shoulder. When his bleary eyes faced forward again and he saw the size of the assembly awaiting him, he jumped once more. Walter, who occupied a position of strategic importance in the middle of the room with Hancock and Henry, ignored the nervous shoemaker and cast a look of disdain at the man in a bedraggled religious habit.
"What brings you here on such a night, Mr. Danforth?"
Raleigh demanded.
"Sir Walter,"
Danforth said with a bow, taking a cap from his head and twisting it between his fingers. He spotted the Earl of Northumberland.
"My lord, I did not know you were still among us."
"Is there something you need?"
Matthew asked pleasantly. He remained seated, legs stretched out in apparent relaxation.
"Ah, Master Royden."
Danforth made another bow, this one directed at us. He gave me a curious look before fear overtook him and redirected his eyes to his hat.
"We have not seen you in church or in town. Bidwell thought you might be indisposed."
Bidwell shifted on his feet. The leather boots he wore squelched and complained, and the man's lungs joined in the chorus with wheezes and a barking cough. A wilted ruff constricted his windpipe and quivered every time he tried to draw a breath. Its pleated linen was distinctly the worse for wear, and a greasy brown spot near his chin suggested he'd had gravy with supper.
"Yes, I was taken sick in Chester, but it is past with God's grace and thanks to my wife's care."
Matthew reached out and clasped my hand with husbandly devotion.
"My physician thought it would be best if my hair were shorn to rid me of the fever. But it was Diana's insistence on cool baths that made the difference."
"Wife," Danforth said faintly. "Widow Beaton did not tell me.
I do not share my private affairs with ignorant women, Matthew said sharply.
Bidwell sneezed. Matthew examined him first with concern, then with a carefully managed look of dawning understanding. I was learning a great deal about my husband this evening, including the fact that he could be a surprisingly good actor.
Oh, but of course you are here to ask Diana to cure Bidwell.
Matthew made a sound of regret.
There is so much idle gossip. Has the news of my wife's skill spread already?
In this period, medicinal knowledge was perilously close to a witch's lore. Was Matthew trying to get me in trouble?
Bidwell wanted to respond, but all he could manage was a gurgle and a shake of his head.
If you're not here for physic, then you must be here to deliver Diana's shoes.
Matthew looked at me fondly, then to the minister.
As you have no doubt heard, my wife's possessions were lost during our journey, Mr. Danforth.
Matthew's attention returned to the shoemaker, and a shade of reproach crept into his tone.
I know you are a busy man, Bidwell, but I hope you finished the patterns at least. Diana's determined to go to church this week, and the path to the vestry is often flooded. Someone really should see to it.
Iffley's chest had been swelling with indignation since Matthew had started speaking. Finally, the man could stand it no more.
Bidwell brought the shoes you paid for, but we are not here to secure your wife's services or trifle with patterns and puddles.
Iffley drew his cloak around his hips in a gesture that was intended to convey dignity, but the soaked wool only emphasized his resemblance to a drowned rat, with his pointy nose and beady eyes.
Tell her, Mr. Danforth!
The Reverend Danforth looked as though he would rather be roasting in hell than standing in Matthew Royden's house, confronting his wife.
"Go on, tell her," urged Iffley.
"Allegations have been made."
That was as far as Danforth got before Walter, Henry, and Hancock closed ranks.
"If you are here to make allegations, sir, you can direct them to me or to his lordship," Walter said sharply.
"Or to me," George piped up. "I am well read in the law."
Yes, well."
The cleric subsided into silence.
"Widow Beaton has fallen ill. So is young Bidwell," said Iffley, determined to forge on in spite of Danforth's failing nerve.
"No doubt it is the same ague that afflicted me and now the boy's father," my husband said softly. His fingers tightened on mine.
Behind me, Galloglass swore under his breath.
"Of what exactly are you accusing my wife, Iffley?"
"Widow Beaton refused to join her in some evil business. Mistress Royden vowed to afflict her joints and head with pains."
"My son has lost his hearing," Bidwell complained, his voice thick with misery and phlegm.
"There is a fierce ringing in his ears, like unto the sound of a bell. Widow Beaton says he's been bewitched."
"No," I whispered. The blood left my head in a sudden, startling drop. Galloglass's hands were on my shoulders in an instant, keeping me upright. The word bewitched had me staring into a familiar abyss. My greatest fear had always been that humans would discover I was descended from Bridget Bishop. Then the curious glances would start, and the suspicions. The only possible response was flight. I tried to worm my fingers from Matthew's grasp, but he might as well have been made of stone for all the good it did me, and Galloglass still had charge of my shoulders.
"Widow Beaton has long suffered from rheumatism, and Bidwell's son has recurrent putrid throats. They often cause pain and deafness. These illnesses occurred before my wife came to Woodstock."
Matthew made a lazy, dismissive gesture with his free hand. "The old woman is jealous of Diana's skill, and young Joseph was taken with her beauty and envious of my married state. These are not allegations, but idle imaginings."
"As a man of God, Master Royden, it is my responsibility to take them seriously. I have been reading."
Mr. Danforth reached into his black robes and pulled out a tattered sheaf of papers. It was no more than a few dozen sheets, crudely stitched together with coarse string.
Time and heavy use had softened the paper's fibers, fraying the edges and turning the pages gray. I was too far away to make out the title page. All three vampires saw it, though. So did George, who blanched. That's part of the Malleus Maleficarum.
I did not know that your Latin was good enough to comprehend such a difficult work, Mr. Danforth, Matthew said.
It was the most influential witch-hunting manual ever produced, and a title that struck terror into a witch's heart. The minister looked affronted.
I attended university, Master Royden.
I'm relieved to hear it. That book shouldn't be in the possession of the weak-minded or superstitious.
You know it? Danforth asked.
I, too, attended university, Matthew replied mildly.
Then you understand why I must question this woman.
Danforth attempted to advance into the room. Hancock's low growl brought him to a standstill.
My wife has no difficulties with her hearing. You needn't come closer.
I told you Mistress Royden has unnatural powers, Iffley said triumphantly.
Danforth gripped his book.
Who taught you these things, Mistress Royden? He called down the echoing expanse of the hall. From whom did you learn your witchcraft?
This was how the madness began, with questions designed to trap the accused into condemning other creatures. One life at a time, witches were caught up in the web of lies and destroyed. Thousands of my people had been tortured or killed thanks to such tactics. Denials burbled up into my throat.
Don't.
Matthew's single word of warning was uttered in an icy murmur.
Strange things are happening in Woodstock. A white stag crossed Widow Beaton's path, Danforth continued. It stopped in the road and stared until her flesh turned cold. Last night a grey wolf was seen outside her house. Its eyes glowed in the darkness, brighter than the lamps that were hung out to help travellers find shelter in the storm. Which of these creatures is your familiar? Who gifted you with it?
Matthew didn't need to tell me to keep silent this time. The priest's questions were following a well-known pattern, one I had studied in graduate school.
The witch must answer your questions, Mr. Danforth, Iffley insisted, pulling at his companion's sleeve. Such insolence from a creature of darkness cannot be allowed in a godly community.
My wife speaks to no one without my consent, said Matthew, and mind whom you call witch, Iffley.
The more the villagers challenged him, the harder it was for Matthew to restrain himself. The minister's eyes traveled from me to Matthew and back again. I stifled a whimper.
Her agreement with the devil makes it impossible for her to speak the truth, Bidwell said.
Hush, Master Bidwell, Danforth chided. What do you wish to say, my child? Who introduced you to the devil? Was it another woman?
Or man, Iffley said under his breath. Mistress Royden is not the only child of darkness to be found here. There are strange books and instruments, and midnight gatherings are held to conjure spirits.
Harriet sighed and thrust his book at Danforth. Mathematics, sir, not magic. Widow Beaton spotted a geometry text.
It is not your place to determine the extent of the evil here, Iffley sputtered.
If it's evil you're seeking, look for it at Widow Beaton's.
Though he'd done his best to remain calm, Matthew was rapidly losing his temper.
Do you accuse her of witchcraft, then? Danforth asked sharply.
No, Matthew. Not that way, I whispered, tugging on his hand to gain his attention. Matthew turned to me. His face looked inhuman, his pupils glassy and enormous. I shook my head and he took a deep breath, trying to calm both his fury at the invasion of his home and his fierce instinct to protect me.
Stop your ears against his words, Mr. Danforth. Royden might be an instrument of the devil, too, Iffley warned.
Matthew faced the delegation.
If you have reason to charge my wife with some offense, find a magistrate and do so. Otherwise, get out.
And before you return, Danforth, consider whether aligning with Iffley and Bidwell is a wise course of action. The parson gulped.
You heard him, Hancock barked. Out!
Justice will be served, Master Royden. God's justice, Danforth proclaimed as he backed out of the room.
Only if my version doesn't resolve the matter first, Danforth, Walter promised.
Pierre and Charles materialized from the shadows, throwing open the doors to shepherd the wide-eyed warmbloods from the room. Outside it was a blowing gale. The fierceness of the waiting storm would only confirm their suspicions about my supernatural powers. Out, 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 called an insistent voice in my head. Panic flooded my system with adrenaline. I had been reduced to prey once more. Galloglass and Hancock turned toward me, intrigued by the scent of fear seeping from my pores.
Stay where you are, Matthew warned the vampires.
He crouched before me.
Diana's instincts are telling her to flee. She'll be fine in a moment.
This is never going to end. We came for help, but even here I'm hunted. I bit my lip.
There's nothing to fear. Danforth and Iffley will think twice before causing any more trouble, Matthew said firmly, taking my clasped hands in his. No one wants me for an enemy. Not other creatures, not the humans.
I understand why the creatures might fear you. You're a member of the congregation and have the power to destroy them. No wonder Widow Beaton came here when you commanded. But that doesn't explain this human reaction to you. Danforth and Iffley must suspect that you're a... Puerch. I caught myself just before the word vampire spilled out.
Oh, he's in no danger from them, said Hancock dismissively. These men are nobodies. Unfortunately, they're likely to bring this business to the attention of humans who do matter.
Ignore him, Matthew told me. Which humans? I whispered. Galloglass gasped.
By all that is holy, Matthew, I've seen you do terrible things, but how could you keep this from your wife, too?
Matthew looked into the fire. When his eyes finally met mine, they were filled with regret. Matthew? I prompted. The knot that had been forming in my stomach since the arrival of the first bag of mail tightened further.
They don't think I'm a vampire. They know I'm a spy,